Mr. Man Real 2. We've been talking about your working life, Mr. Man. What was it like as a young adolescent boy growing up in the 1930s?
Well, there wasn't sort of entertainment or television or radio. The first radio or wireless that I remember us getting was when I was about 15, 16 years old, which Dad bought, and that was a second-hand one from one of the neighbours. He used to listen to that a bit. He used to get programmes on the stuff in there, but it was never a case of sitting down for hours or two. They just get a bit sick now. But the, as I say, it was more or less the cinema. I used to go a lot of walks that day, and as I say, with this, going up to my pals and doing these runs and the gym equipment, as I might call it there, used to keep pretty healthy. Swimming as well, with a swim. I think till I got to the age of 16, and I bought an old motorbike. It was a little Coventry Eagle, two-stroke, and I paid £4 for that in those days. Top speed was about 35 miles an hour, and I had a pal. He had a better motorbike, which his uncle had bought him. And he was saying, well, what's top speed on mine? There's no speed on this one, and I think it worked out about 35 miles an hour. So that was almost 16 or there. But prior to that, I think my life was more or less dedicated. Oh, so I was very interested in mechanical bits as regards a bicycle, say. And my dad used to bring me some of the other policemen's bikes at times and, you know, repair the three-speed or put a new rim round the for the wheel. It was a passing time with that, and then eventually got onto a new motorbike, which in that stage. But mainly, I think it was just out for walks, fresh air, before that.
Did girls come into your life at this stage?
I wasn't really interested in a lot of girls, to be quite honest. I think more or less getting to where it was to the army. I don't remember going with girls prior to the army. More or less the boys. I mean, we weren't gay or anything like that, and sex was a thing that was even forbidden to talk about, let alone anything else. They used to be the mistress of life, I suppose. I remember pals who, even when we was at school or past that, I mean, we asked them, where'd babies come from? Well, now you can talk to, I suppose, children in just being started school, and the more or less know more about than we ever knew. But, the girls didn't come into to more or less to join the army.
Again, living in the 1930s, were you personally, as a young man, becoming aware that things were happening on the continent, with Germany particularly?
Well, not really prior to it, I would say. It never sort of come. The first time I think it really was September the 3rd, 1939, when the war was declared, and we heard this on the radio. And with pal and me, we went off and went down to Musk near Redcliffe, as I say, on the motorbikes, and we took a tent, put a little tent there, and it was go swimming in the sea. And then it realised that a war had actually started. But even then, you know, you said, well, what do we know about the war? And you know what my dad had told me, which was only little bits. He was a sergeant in the First World War in the Guards. And he used to tell me a bit about France and say, one day I'll take you to France. Well, that day never matured, in spite of him having free passes from his occupation as a railway policeman, which we could have travelled over the continent and around with the free passes. But he never took me. I suppose more or less due to the ill health of my mother, so no, and she wouldn't travel. Poor traveller.
You say he mentioned little things about army life during the First World War. Did he talk to you about the trenches and the conditions?
Well, he never really talked a lot about it. First of all, Dad. He was wounded twice, and he was gassed, but it didn't have a great effect, the gassing, on his life. But he was wounded in the leg twice, they say. And afterwards, during the latter part of his life, he had medical exams, and apparently if the leg in which he'd been wounded had been 1/8 of an inch shorter, he could have had three built-up boots. Just was 1/8 of an inch. He used to hammer the soles on himself to bring him up to that. But then the really, he had badly trench feet, and he did suffer in his latter years with his feet. The sort of weeping and that, which was all due to the First World War.
So you're down at Marsk on the day that the war broke out.
Right.
What changes, immediate changes, did the war bring to your lives?
Well, after that, of course, the war started off, and that, and I remember hearing about Dunkirk and that, and the Palamine, which I don't know. So I think I'll write officers and see if I can get on to a ship through. Rotner's, a fishing, not a fishing, but shipping firm, Rotner's, wrote off. So we both wrote off together to try and get the more or less cabin boys on the ship. For what we knew about that, all we knew was there were cabin boys, and maybe get the Merchant Navy. But we got replies to say there were no vacancies, so we didn't get on that.
The war for you at that age, about 16, 17 years of age at that time, did it appear as a kind of an exciting adventure to you as a young man?
To be honest, I don't know if it really got exciting. You know, you used to read the papers, but I suppose it didn't mean a lot to us, same as what the war might mean to people nowadays. They don't really know what it is. You would read it, but you couldn't have the sympathies for what was going on as you would when you were aware that it happened. But it got towards the end of 1940, well, it was what, March 41 when I actually joined, but it was getting to the end of 40, and father says, oh, this war, I think maybe we should join the forces, something like that.
Did you? Parents, they would know as the war went on particularly that you were likely to be pulled into it anyway. Was there a fear? Your father had been through the First World War.
Yeah.
Were they afraid for you?
If they were afraid, they didn't show it. It was only a case of, I didn't even tell my parents I was going for a medical exam for the forces. And it only went after I'd passed the medical exam, which was A1, and when I went back to work and said, oh, I'd passed this medical A1, he said, so what didn't you expect going into the army? But it was only after that they told me plans Monday I was joining the forces.
And how did they take that?
Well, Daddy, he sort of says, he says, it's not the best of lives that you're going to. He said, you have some very hard times ago, son. Which turned out to be true, of course. But
your mother, was she?
Mother, well, it was a loving mother, caring mother. She always thought I was the lovely, innocent little boy and that. And I think she shed a few tears at the time when I told her I was going. But as it was, it maybe eased the situation a bit by just going to Hyington, which was only a walk away from home.
So we've got to establish the fact that you were volunteering. At this point, you weren't being conscripted. It was a voluntary thing.
Well, but when Paolo said, oh, look, join up, it got round till this March, and we went down to Leadenhall Street to the recruiting office. I went in there and said, you went to join the forces. Please, the pal that had joined up with me, he'd applied for the Royal Air Force. They'd been to Paddington, really. I was turned down for the Air Force. But we went down to the Leadenhall Street and said, we'd like to join the Army. And I remember saying that I should like to be in the, well, I said, three regiments, which would you like to choose? So I said, well, I'd like to be in the signals, because I was motorbike mad at that time. I was never motorbike. Petrol was rationed, of course, by then, so you restricted signals. I said, or the service corps, or the ordnance corps. Because really, it hadn't been started up by then. And the service corps and the ordnance corps was connected with the motor trade. So I said, well, first of all, you go to a battalion for your training. He said, and after that, you'll go to one of the battalions of your choice. So that was fair. So we signed up, we got the King's shilling.
Did you have to make the promise, you know, the over the, you had to have to swear over the Bible to?
Oh, yes, and you got the King's shilling. The shilling, I've given to you that, what you were liable for, your duty to king and country and all that. And I had that for years, but I don't know where it is now, that declaration. But anyhow, cut a long story short, it was the home training to the Durham Light Infantry, which was this young soldier's battalion.
So after doing your signing on at the recruiting office, you came home then, did you? And awaited your call up, or awaited your instructions?
It was a Friday that I went down to volunteer. Sorry. It was a Friday that I had the medical and the signing in, receiving the shilling. So actually, I suppose you could say from that moment you were in the army. And he says, right, Monday you'll report to this battalion for a training, which was to Hamilton.
What was the medical like that they gave you? Was it a pretty wide medical?
Well, I'm surprised anybody ever failed it from the medical. It was the usual thing, strip off, and the man would stand behind, or the doctor support would stand behind you, and he would whisper something like, can you hear me, or something like that. And of course you could hear him, and with all for the optics and that, these letters up there on the side, and you couldn't help but miss them. And they tested your chest and that with a stethoscope, and grab all you and tell you to cough. And I think that was about your medical. They'd ask you if you had any ill health or anything like that. But it wasn't much of medical. You were just there, signed up, and you were in. I suppose, like, some of them, they were found out later that they weren't suitable, and then they were discharged from the forces. No, the medical, it was a bit of a hit and a miss thing. I only learned later through life that the major there, he had a son who was an officer in the 70th, and that's why he was pushing these youngsters to the 70th, the Durham Light Infantry and all that. But he now went to Bransworth, which some of the later lads went to, Infantry Training Centre, straight to Agus Costa, who were just starting to build up the 70th Battalion. And it was B Company I went into there.
And this was on the Monday, you say?
On the Monday.
And where did you go to?
Hamilton, to school ATF at Hamilton. There. They were in hospital, I think, at one time as well. They went to report in, and there was the guard room. They brought you in, and there was a lad on sentry there. Of course, you weren't supposed to speak, as you know, on sentry duty. And we were just young civvies there. And he said, Morris says, you come to join this for us? He says, well, he says, you're left off. I said, you wouldn't come. And yeah, we went in and reported the guard room, and for that we were taken down to the orderly room by who would be the stick orderly. It was, when you used to go on guard, there used to be four of you actually, and one was selected as stick orderly. Supposed to be the smartest on parade, and you did the roundabout between the orderly room and the guards room, or messages to the officer. And he took us down to the orderly room, and they just your name and address, and they allocated you a number. And from there, they were shown down to these, I don't know, they call it barracks, but we're shown. out of the building, had a vehicle. It was being assembled, made up.
Do you recall your army number?
I recall it now, 446-8480, which was a DLI number, 44, well, DLI numbers. Later, the lads have got national service numbers, which was a longer number, and I think they started off something like 145 and lower, they went through there. But from there, I think the next day they took us down to the...
Can you describe to me what the barracks were like that you were put into?
Well, so what it was after, I would say they were very comfortable. We were allocated a bed, which was a metal lion bed, and it had not a sprung mattress, but just a wire stretch mattress across it, and we were issued with a palliass. This palliass, they took us up to the hay store, and we used to stuff the palliass with hay to make a mattress. But this pal I joined up with, I put pay in mind. I thought, oh, that's sufficient there, but he wanted more, and he said he didn't like a hard bed. Well, he put that much straw in it, and he got down the next morning, he was supposed to double his palliass to make the bed up, and there was that much straw in it, he couldn't double his palliass. And the blanket issue was three at that time, three blankets, one on the top, and by God, they were a bit of rough stuff as well. Calico didn't come into it, I don't think. But, as I say, it was a bed, it was a palliass, and no pillar, and the three blankets. There was wash basins, and there was actually a bath in the barracks. I call it barracks, but there was one bath, I remember. And this I only got after shortly being in, I got scabies. But anyhow, this sort of common enough thing. And he used to have to go on into this bath, have a good hot soak, and after to the medical room there, and then he used to plaster this Jensen violet, purple coloured stuff all over where the scabies were.
How many was there in a room?
In a room, I'd say roughly a plateau, which would be around over 30 to a room.
And was there a senior NCO with you in the room?
The sergeant had a little room off the bottom of the I suppose you could call it a ward, almost like a hospital ward, and a little room at the bottom, and the sergeant was in there. And there's a corporal, Sergeant Pallister was the sergeant then, I know, but he was a real old soldier. He must have been in his 50s, I would think, at that time. Well, I can remember of him.
He must have been a First World War veteran, was he?
Oh, yes, definitely. And then there was a Corporal Allen after him, and he'd seen service in India and that before the war, and that, the regular soldier. The company sergeant major was Ernie Eldred. By God, he was a right old soldier. I think he'd been in the Chinese Rebellion or Indian Mutiny, something like that. He'd been there. By a cruder man you couldn't have met. And he was short, but solid as a rock. He had a neck a bit like a bull, you know, a young bull there. He used to take on bayonet training, and after going through the usual, throw a sack in a bit of a frame, bayonet drill, and he would get a stick which would be right about 6 foot long, I should think, roughly. On one end was a ring about 4 inches in diameter, and the idea was that he would position it in different places and moving it there, and you had to try and get your bayonet through this loop. But what was it? The end of the stick, it was wrapped up, something, there's two or three sticks, some were just wrapped up with rags and that, and I remember one particular one had a boxing glove on it, and of course if you miss getting your bayonet into this loop, you've got to clout across the head with this boxing glove at the end of the stick. But it was sort of a fearless man, like.
Were they good NCOs? In terms of army ability?
Well, Sergeant Pallister, the first one, I would put him down as being a cushy man. It seemed to be easy. Of course, then again, when you recruit, maybe it was just to break us into what we're in for later on. But Corporal Allen, he was a bit more fiercer. He was a full corporal. He used to go on. It's funny, Corporal Allen and I. Maybe we weren't friends by any means or anything like that. But whenever there was like escort duty to do, to go and bring someone back who'd gone absent without leave, maybe detained in the local army place or in the police station, and quite often it used to be me go with this Corporal Allen to bring him back. We went to York once, and there was a lad, dear me, the size of him, I think, if he'd be really set about us, he could be cleared me, or they're going to clear Corporal Allen as well. And he was held at Strensford Barracks, York, I remember that. And he'd gone with him, he had his bayonet at the side, and so we come back from York with him, handcuffed him, of course, and handcuffed. And I had these two, I had my own bayonet, which he used to carry on escort duty, and had his bayonet one side and mine the other round my belt.
How did you take to the language of the army then? You've mentioned that the CSM was pretty fierce.
I suppose it had a bit of a secluded life really to come in, but you learned quickly and got used to it. And especially this sergeant major, well, I think his dictionary like was one that's never been printed. What he used to call people and
discipline, did you take to the discipline okay?
Yes, I think I sort of put up with it in that respect. There were odd ones, of course, that they didn't take to the discipline. But this Corporal Allen I tell you about, he says it comes past the line. He used to get every weekend past the guy. And of course, you would get your passes through. Would call you round and issue the passes out. But then you have to say, you're for when this Corporal Allen, he used to issue the passes there. And he says, right, you all got your passes. And so naturally we thought, come midday, we could be off. But he set us on. Before we go, we had to scrub out this ward, as it was, under the beds and dust it down a lot. But instead of getting away about 12 o'clock, I think it was around about 2 o'clock when we got away, which we didn't take. Well, so
I was going to ask you about how we kept the ward clean, or the barrack clean, which of course you've mentioned by scrubbing it and so forth.
Yeah.
How was the building heated?
I don't think it was heated, from what I can remember. Oh, sorry. No, was it there? I'm maybe getting a bit mixed here. Maybe it was in Nissan or Tony Major where they used to have a stove, just one stove in, maybe about 30 of you in the hut, and there was just this one little stove which you used to get a bucket of cold ration, and that was it in the cold weather.
This, of course, was a pretty brand new building, or buildings,
well,
weren't they?
That's what I say. Yeah. I suppose really, we could, looking back, you could say, well, it was a luxury hotel.
So you had to scrub the floors obviously and keep the building clean. Was that a daily duty?
No, I didn't use to scrub it daily. Dusting the floor, you more or less, whether it was clean or not. But when there was an inspection or a kit inspection, because they used to go through, and if there was a bit of dust, the sergeant or the platoon officer, they would emphasise on it, a bit of dust here, and you'd think with a sack full of dust that tells all this dust and get it cleaned, and it would just stop your liberty.
You've mentioned kit inspection. How did that go?
Kit inspection, well, you probably know, just lay all the bits and pieces out of the bed, and there was not the Sergeant Pallister, I think it was Sergeant Rudd they called him later, and he was a bit more vicious, and it was looking like him to knock things off your bed or tip all your blankets off if it weren't equally folded smartly up on the head of the bed, and they had to set it all up again. Until he come round and check you out and that.
Was that a regular feature of barrack life?
Pretty regular, yeah, get inspections. I mean, Aycliffe, the Darlington itself, while it's only, what, 7 miles, was out of bounds. Bishop Auckland was out of bounds. Hindon was in bounds. And Shildon was in bounds. So you had to have a pass to go to the other places. You couldn't go. But we did use the pop out at times. I remember one instance, Darlington, whilst he was out of bounds, there was a Northern Command exercise on, which all that if you go out of the camp, you'll wear your tin hat, respirator with your nurse, which was on your chest, your gas cape rolled up and on across the back of your shoulders, and you'd wear the gas mask, the goggles, anti-gas goggles, which were more like a plastic goggle. So this poor man who joined up at the time, he said he was going home, going to call home.
What did they call him, by the way?
Watson. What called Watson. And he was going to go home, lived closest in Darlington. So apparently he got a lift into Darlington. When the farm few between getting lifts into Darlington when we used to go. But anyway, he came in and he had his tin hat on and respirator and all this stuff, you know. And when he got in the outskirts of Darlington, he noticed that there was soldiers there, but they hadn't got this dress he had on. They just had the normal forest cap and the respirator slung over the shoulder down by the side. And he thought, well, dear, they were going down, and then they were looking like they'd be going back with a tin hat on and goggles on and respirator. So I just turned around and come back to camp.
You said there were 30, around 30 people in your platoon. Did your platoon have a number? Or?
I think it was 13 platoon. I thought about this after you'd been on the phone. I'm pretty sure that the one that I was in was 13 platoon, B company.
What were the chaps like that were in the platoon with you?
There was a right assortment, I suppose, in one way. There was one lad called Fryer who actually came from Darlington, and the problem with him was that marching, he could never march the same pace steps. He took shorter paces than the rest of you, and if you were behind him, it was you couldn't follow him. He was sat though, and eventually, I think he was discharged. And then there was another one called Leonard. He was from the coast somewhere, I think. This will get no easy to this one later. But he hardly ever washed himself. Though I say hardly washed himself, he had to wash himself. Went on playing, but he had to wash himself after what. But he had a bit of problems with his bowels and that at times. There again, he got a discharge. Another one was Ginger Thurkle, Sunderland lad, and he used to go on acting as though he was had the dull lollipop, as they call it, too much sun. And he would go outside the Sergeant Major's room and he'd take his ground sheet laid on the floor and pretend he was praying like for the East on the morning to try and get his ticket. I don't think he ever got his ticket, not while I was with him.